This is the Lean Discovery Applied podcast with Clinton Sanko, Baker Donaldson's e-discovery officer. In season one of Sitting with the C-Suite, Clinton and guests will explore the e-discovery industry's past, present, and future, largely through the eyes of the executives responsible for the technology and services underlying virtually every e-discovery project.
Hello, I'm Clinton Sanko, and welcome to the Lean Discovery series, Sitting with the C-Suite, where we are committed to unraveling e-discovery, one interview at a time. Today we are joined by Dan Regard, a lawyer and computer scientist who founded iDiscovery Solutions in January of 2008. Join me in welcoming Dan to the show.
Clinton, good morning. It's a pleasure to see you.
So Dan, tell us a little bit about IDS, the company, the services that you offer. Just give us a flavor of IDS as it exists today.
IDS is a full-service e-discovery consulting and advisory firm. Our mission is literally to influence the intersection of law and technology. We're probably best known for our deep bench of subject matter experts and our testimony in support of analysis and analytics. We're particularly adept at digital forensics, cybersecurity, predictive coding, and structured data.
So in my research getting ready for today, I found on the internet that it looks like you started IDS around January of 2008. And of course, we're going to talk a little bit more about your background in a bit, kind of as a computer scientist and a lawyer. What did you see in 2008 that you thought, boy, this is a real niche that needs to be solved, or this is an area where the market's ready or has kind of availability for a new entrant along the lines of IDS, which you formed?
Well, the company started in 2008, but my career did not. So I had been involved in legal technology since the late 1980s and early 1990s. I had just finished off working with Deloitte & Touche, FTI, and LECG, building e-discovery teams from scratch, and had already contemplated going on my own on prior occasions. So in January 2008, it was an easy transition for me, and at the time, my co-founder, Neil Lawson, to pivot from working inside of a larger organization to running our own organization. We already had the client base. The idea of consulting and making our own bad decisions instead of living with the bad decisions of others seemed very attractive.
And that kind of leads me into my next question. You mentioned a couple of the prior folks that you worked with at these big kind of consulting firms. What were your takeaways from working at those big four, at the bigger organizations that you applied or did differently when you established IDS?
Well, when I joined those practices, first of all, none of them had an e-discovery practice. So they had people who relied on the results of e-discovery, economists, forensic accountants, statisticians who were looking for the raw ingredients of their trade. And my team was often involved in identifying, locating data sources, cleaning those up, extracting them in a reliable fashion and presenting them. So I learned where we fit in the supply chain of expert testimony and expert opinions. I also saw firsthand that the need for that expertise and that technical resource was growing, in my opinion, exponentially. At the same time, I found in those organizations working on a global scale that the issues globally were similar to those in the United States. Different cultures, different regional obligations, but the general direction of the problem was identical. So it gave me a lot of encouragement to move forward, a lot of confidence in approaching a global marketplace. But I also learned, finally, if you're going to do something, be the best at it. And I was really fortunate to work with three spectacular organizations. When I started IDS, naturally, I wanted to be the best at what we do. And through a lot of hard work and a lot of good luck, we recently have been nominated for the third time in a row as one of the top consulting firms in the United States in e-discovery by Chambers and Partners. Not nominated, but named. And so I still think we have more improvements to make, but for right now, I feel really proud about the team we've pulled together and what we've been able to accomplish.
In that last answer, I was intrigued by you said that you were involved at your previous companies more kind of with the results of the e-discovery process. And we know that e-discovery is not an end to itself. It's actually supportive of everything, and that most particularly within litigation, supportive of presenting the evidence that actually matters to the dispute to an eventual trier of fact. I thought it was interesting. I read an article that you contributed to back in August of 2016, and it was on the Internet of Things in the Metropolitan Corporate Council. And in that context, you said, in litigation, we're taught that the classic questions are who, what, and when. And I thought that was a really cool quote that talked about more how e-discovery fits into the process versus as a means and end to itself. What are the two or three things that you think trial lawyers should be more focused on in the e-discovery process to accelerate understanding of the merits and a resolution of the ultimate dispute, that would, you know, everything would benefit from more focus on those areas?
So I actually get this question a lot. What can litigators do to bring the Internet of Things into their toolbox? And as you point out, I think the first step is to take a step backwards. Why do they want to do that? It has to be a means to an end. So we take the process from the end and work backwards. What are the claims and defenses? What are the classic law school 101 prongs of any of these given legal issues? Say, breach of contract. Was there a contract? Was it breached? Were there damages? These we can then turn into measurable aspects. And then we can find data to help us measure that. So was there a contract might be manifested not only in the words of the contract, but the behaviors of the parties to buy certain products or sell certain products. We can look at their product purchase or transaction log from a data perspective and see that there was a point in time, an inflection point, where purchases started or where they stopped or where geography changed. So the data reflects the behavior that reflects the agreement. So we find where data can help us articulate or measure or quantify the aspects of a claim or defense, and then we identify where that data is, and that's where the Internet of Things comes in, because it's tracking what people are doing, when they're doing it, where they are when they're doing it. And if we can harness that data, we can turn that data into a digital witness, if you were, instead of a human witness, to the history of events that led up to the dispute.
You know, that's an interesting answer. And back in May of 2018, you and I both spoke at the 75th Annual Judicial Conference for the Sixth Circuit. And I remember your presentation focusing on that point, the digital footprint and what you can learn from structured data as it's distinct from email and unstructured data. Flashing forward now, it's about 2 years since that conference. What are the kind of exciting things that you're seeing developing around that kind of pure play around structured data and that digital footprint concept as a, to use your term, digital witness?
Well, one of the things that we're seeing is that as we look to data as being the recorder of events in human actions and its ability to tell us what the answer is, or at least some of the answers, data can be actually more informative and more accessible than unstructured documents, emails and memos. I like to describe it as follows. Would you like to know what a given witness said they were doing at a given date and time? Or would you rather know what they were actually doing? And most counsel would say they'd like to know what they were actually doing and maybe use what they said they were doing to validate their credibility as a witness. And so we're seeing data really take a forefront position in a lot of cases. Like e-commerce, like social media, like everything in Silicon Valley, data is the new oil. And it's that fuel, it's that energy for litigation as well. It's the new commodity. When we use it, and we use it correctly, we're also seeing some fantastic transformative outcomes. I've said this several times to other audiences, but it's true. We're starting to see lawsuits where the number of documents that are needed to resolve factual issues, the document population is dropping dramatically, and we've had lawsuits where no documents were needed at all. No emails were reviewed, much less collected. And the resolution could be had based on transactional data instead of written data. It's amazing. And we've seen that trend continue both before you and I gave that lecture and in the 2 years since.
I remember during that lecture, Dan, that you gave an example. I remember the guy's picture. I think you called him Wally, but I'm not sure if that's right or not. But I remember his picture, and I remember the service truck example where you walked through what the data showed about what this technician was doing versus what the claims in the case were and that the class was making. I think it was an employment dispute. Can you give our listeners a good example of this as applied structured data, digital footprint, digital witness trend that you're seeing with structured data?
I'll give you two quick examples. One, we were involved in a call center litigation, and we got called right when the complaint was served. We went into the defendant's organization. We acquired some quick data on when employees were logging into their IP telephony, when they were logging into the call center software, when they were passing through the security turnstiles, which we would call badge swipes. And we were able to show pretty quickly that the average time delay before employees could get engaged and clock in, instead of being the 20 to 40 minutes estimated by the named plaintiff, was actually 2.5 to 3 minutes. Significant change. We showed that to both parties, defendants and plaintiffs, and the case was dropped. That's a quick resolution because there was no smoke, there was no fire. In a much more significant case involving 11,000 employees, we ended up dealing with parties that were sophisticated on both sides. And the plaintiffs had done some really great homework and came out with a list of systems they were aware of for production that contained data elements related to dispatch, service, delivery, compensation, and we collected that data. It turned out to be an enormous amount of data, 11,000 employees over a 10-year period, three different divisions. It was 90 billion records that we collected and a billion records that were produced. And in the end, those records helped all the parties and the court resolve the litigation. They dismissed, the class action was dismissed, but there was still a settlement negotiation between the plaintiffs and the defendants informed by the data. That was amazing on several aspects. One, that we could deal with that volume of data. Number two, that we had the tools to analyze it. And number three, that we could resolve a 10-year, 11,000-member class action, again, with no emails at all. So that's a testament to the power of the data that's emerged from the world around us as we've digitized our businesses and our lives, and the power of answering factual questions in a court of dispute resolution using that data.
Dan, in August of 2019, you co-wrote a blog entitled Pro Bono in eDiscovery, and you outlined in that blog IDS's approach to pro bono activities and the importance that IDS places it on that conduct. Tell us a little bit about your pro bono activities as a company and why you're so focused on that.
Pro bono has been a pet project of mine since IDS started. Recently, we were asked to go public with our pro bono program, more to be a role model for other consultancies and expert witnesses and consultants than because we didn't have a program. The reason it's been a passion of mine and the reason we've done pro bono projects since the inception of IDS is really quite simple. I'm a part of the group of individuals, the circle within the Sedona Conference, we call it the Sedona Bubble, who believe that e-discovery is really important for getting to the facts of cases, and it's really important for the resolution of disputes. It's really, to me, not possible to say on one hand that it's essential to the resolution of disputes, and on the other hand, say that it's not available to those who can't afford it. So we've provided pro bono services since day one because I think it is an essential component to both criminal and civil litigation. And as a result, we've had an opportunity to work on some really important cases, some really exciting, challenging, and professionally rewarding cases, and some cases that to us may seem run-of-the-mill, but I can promise you to the defendants were anything but run-of-the-mill. To them, the issues were extraordinarily important, even though the manner of the services we provided were not. We're working today in issues that involve environmental protection, that involve immigrant employees, that involved secret detainees and black prisons around the world. And we've worked on issues involving civil rights. So the reward, spiritually, morally, professionally, and intellectually, has been super high, but it still boils down to the fundamental concept. It's essential if we're going to live in a world where data analytics and e-discovery is part of the process, we have to make sure it's available to everybody, those who can afford it and those who can't.
I follow you on LinkedIn, Dan, and you've been pretty active on LinkedIn. And recently you were talking about the measuring stick of the standards that you use to measure your conduct by. And you said, quote, "There is a time to be absolute in our actions and a time when it is wiser to be relative. Choosing the wrong standard can have a huge impact on business or life." What did you mean by that when you were talking about absolute versus relative standards?
Clinton, you ask really good questions. The relative or absolute measuring stick is not the idea that you should only have one stick, but rather you should know when to use which stick. And so you can use both. In your example, both are acceptable answers. Some additional goals that I've heard recently are, I want to reduce the amount of document review spend in my cases. Well, reducing is a relative measurement. I want to spend less today than I did yesterday. At the same time, I have clients who say they want to eliminate document review from their cases. It's not a relative measurement. It's an absolute goal. They want zero document review in their cases. And we're trying to help them find ways to achieve that. So there's an example of relative and absolute. Similar issue, different measurement.
Dan, as a lawyer who services a lot of different types of clients, if you were to focus on your corporate clients and you were to advise them, here's the one or two or three standards that you should use to measure the efficacy of your e-discovery management, what would those standards be, and could you categorize them as absolute or relative as you go through what your top ones are?
I hadn't thought of it from that perspective. Let me give that a moment's thought. I think the natural reaction for most corporate counsel is measuring the cost per matter as a relative issue. Can we lower the cost and the speed of resolution of individual matters as we look across the portfolio? That I believe in. There are absolute measures as well. I've had corporate counsel come and say it is their absolute standard to not do e-discovery in-house. It's their absolute standard to make sure that they have outside counsel and outside providers so they can leverage the best technologies, the best practices without having to pay for that in-house on a full-time basis. I think those are two examples of relative and absolute from a corporate perspective. Right now, we have corporate counsel who are relatively looking for increasing the amount of structured data in their analysis because they see it as a cheaper, faster, more objective way to resolve factual questions, even while they still continue to provide their obligations around discovery, which still tend to be largely focused on document requests for emails and document management content.
I spent some time preparing for this interview, Dan, and if you search for Dan Regard eDiscovery on Google, it's amazing the amount of material that's out about you as a person, your background, your history. And I read this July 2014, so we're going back several years here, Dan. You were on a series entitled Profiles in Success. And there was this quote from you in there that I thought was really interesting. You were talking about the experience that you had as a first-year law student and kind of the varied experience that you brought that was relatively non-traditional. And you said that experience, quote, "confirm for me that there are often alternatives to the established ways of doing things if you are willing to put in the time and energy to bring them to fruition. Engaging with your environment, asking questions, being creative, and having a friendly attitude can really open a lot of doors. In this new pandemic environment, we're faced with a brand new set of challenges, a brand new environment. How do you personally apply that life principle about being creative and engaging with your environment in this difficult setting? And how would you advise our listeners to do the same in their world?
So first of all, let me make a disclosure. We're conducting this interview from my undisclosed global headquarters in central Pennsylvania, where I've relocated for the pendency of the pandemic. We're here living with my in-laws, enjoying their help with our family, as well as us providing them much appreciated company and cooking skills here in their undisclosed global headquarters. There is nothing that I can say about COVID or the pandemic that is other than the fact that this is a tragedy, this is a crisis, and it deserves both our attention as well as our contribution. From a company perspective, we've reoriented our entire company around adhering to secure in place, allowing remote work from home, both for the safety of our employees as well as the safety of our clients. And my team has done an amazing job pivoting and allowing that to happen. At the same time, while we spend 90% of our time dealing with the adherence to best practices and safety measures around COVID, taking care of employees, taking care of mental health issues, we actually have a committee now that's focused on COVID opportunities. And it's not to suggest that there is a silver lining, but in a time of great disruption, we find that technologies change, ideas change, business service methodologies change, and we want to be a part of that. In fact, we want to drive it. So we have changed our computer forensic methodologies to enable remote kits and remote collections. We have focused on client engagements through virtual meetings and virtual opportunities. We've looked at new geographies. We see now with everyone remote, the fact that my client may have one of my competitors 100 yards away is irrelevant. I now have equal access to my marketplace, whether I'm 100 yards away or 1,000 miles away, because everyone is working virtually in the cyberspace of the internet. So there are some changes. And I've also been lucky enough to be working with Georgetown University for their annual conference on e-discovery, the Advanced Institute for e-discovery, where I'm working with the committee for the enhanced experience, because we think that there are some advantages to having a remote conference that will be expressed through what we'll see in Georgetown this fall. The ability to get speakers who were otherwise unavailable because of time limitations, we can now get because we only need them for the duration of the lecture. To get people to interact, to get people from an international marketplace to participate, to contribute their ideas where travel would have been cost prohibitive or time prohibitive. So when you look at the process and you look at the challenges and you look at the change, this in some ways is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to accelerate pharmaceutical science, to accelerate clinical testing, to accelerate the evolvement, the evolution of a vaccine, and to elevate or accelerate business change. Now, I can't really affect the first three because it's not my industry, but I can affect the fourth one, and that's what we're focusing on.
Pivoting back, Dan, to your LinkedIn post, I enjoyed a recent post that you had written on servant leadership. And in that post, what really stood out to me was talking about the need for everyone on a team to have role clarity. And you said, how are we supposed to work together to best address our clients' needs and the company's goals? Without that role clarity, it's just not possible. So looking at kind of managing e-discovery, specifically from the role of in-house counsel managing a team for e-discovery, How would you apply that concept of role clarity if you were in-house counsel managing outside counsel with the e-discovery vendors, the document review specialist? How would you apply that role clarity if you were in-house counsel?
For many people who work in litigation and in incident response, e-discovery, they thrive off the adrenaline of the rush to navigate through the chaos of litigation. No rules, there's no structure, there's no boxes. We went through brilliance, hard work, and tenacity. It's the first responder attitude to legal challenges. And it's a rush, it's fun, it's exciting. It's not efficient. When you look at some of the best trained teams in the world, and I use Special Forces as a role model, they're spectacular what they do. They can go into chaos and succeed despite the chaos, but they do it with a huge amount of training, preparation, structure, and role definition. We want to bring that same best practices to e-discovery. I don't see structure as a hindrance to jumping into chaos. I look at it as an enabler. And at IDS, we've spent the last 2 years developing our own in-house process or defining, on one hand, from a corporate perspective, roles and responsibilities and communication channels, so everyone in the company knows what their job is, what they expect of the company, what the company expects of them, what their chain of command is, and how we can communicate from one end of the organization to the other. Same time, we've also spent the last 12 months developing a project execution methodology that we call STEPS. And this is taking the project management life cycle, the PMBOK, the Project Management Book of Knowledge, and supplementing it with aspects that are particular to litigation, expert testimony, and data analytics to create a six-phase, 29-step project execution that embodies our best practices, our institutional knowledge, hundreds of collective years of experience into one process that not only allows us to execute more economically and more efficiently, but still provides a platform for creative thought input for the experts at the end of the day. So you can have bespoke solutions on top of institutional efficiencies. And so I really think that that's important. And it allows your organization, once you have this structure, to scale. It's hard for a team of really, really talented individuals of 6 or 8 people to become an organization of 80 or 800 with similar quality and execution. We've seen a lot of consolidation in the industry where that has not been the case. And I hear clients say, I like company XYZ, but it depends on who you talk to. I want people to say, I like iDiscovery, and it doesn't depend who you talk to. You get similar quality from everybody. So that's really important to us. Every employee who joins our company gets one book, the Checklist Manifesto. Wow, what an impact. And then they get a second book, Traction, which is this business methodology that we've adapted. And it talks about this structure, and it's on this structure that we build the foundation for creativity.
Dan, looking in your crystal ball and thinking about what's to come, specifically in these uncertain times, can you give me a major prediction for the next 12 months, first about the e-discovery outlook, whether it be a technology or a process development? What's your major prediction there? And then for legal tech more generally, kind of outside the context of e-discovery?
My crystal ball, and they're both, not surprisingly, COVID-related. Because of the secure in place and the self-quarantine, it is changing the way people think about the world we live in and the way we interact with the world we live in. And both of those will affect litigation and discovery. Because at the end of the day, litigation is here to present one side of the story against another side of the story in front of a trier of fact. And as a result of what's gone on in the last 3 to 4 months, everybody in the world has become a little bit of a junior data scientist. Everybody is accustomed to looking at data, statistics, charts, trends. We hear the pundits on TV, the ones we trust, and all the rest talk about this is what's happening, these are the standards, and it's all in the measurement of trends and data analytics and projections and models. It's become a part of our vocabulary. And I think that the trier of fact, the judges and the juries of the future, will carry that with them when they think about how to resolve issues. Number two, we had a significant number of the population who were not still on the internet on a regular or daily basis. It wasn't part of their job. It wasn't part of their lifestyle. It wasn't part of their entertainment. It wasn't part of how they provisioned for supplies, whether it be food or dry goods. That has changed. We now have 2, 3, 4 times as many people on the internet at any given moment. All of those actions leave digital footprints. Digital footprints are the oil of litigation dispute resolution in a data-rich world. So we have two things. We're creating a lot more data, and we're creating people who are expecting data to provide them answers. I project over the next 12 months, much more data analytics in dispute resolution and in e-discovery.
Do you have any outlook on legal tech more generally, Dan?
I think that what is happening with machine learning, supervised and unsupervised learning, what much of the audience might consider to be artificial intelligence, what you and I would think of as teaching by example, has made great strides but still has a lot of progress to make. I think that would be really important. I think data privacy being built into our tools into our corporate systems to conceal, mask, pseudo-anonymize personal information will become more and more important as we see even more data privacy laws and regulations enacted on a local, regional, national, or international basis. I think that we will have more solutions for remote team building and team collaboration around e-discovery. That's inevitable, not just from a coordination perspective, but from a work product perspective. That's where I would spend my time and my focus. That's where I do spend my time and my focus in terms of planning for IDS.
At one point, Dan, I remember us having some conversations about a new book that you were writing on structured data, specifically around that concept of the data witness and the history of how litigation and discovery kind of developed and is leading into this new world that you predict is coming down the pike in terms of how juries and triers of fact will determine cases and determine the facts. I'm looking forward to that book, and I was just kind of curious on the current status of it.
So the last jury trial, Litigation in a World of Perfect Information, is still being edited. However, I will say the book has made great strides through my self-imposed quarantine. Not only have I had time to work on the content, this whole episode has, as we just discussed in our last question, added a lot of content for consideration. The pandemic has validated my thesis. It has forced people to work toward dispute resolution without the prospect of trial. Amazing confirmation, my own personal work of passion.
So Dan, I'm getting into the last couple of questions, and these are ones that I ask relatively routinely of my interviewees. My first one is, who is a business leader that you admire? And what are the particular qualities that you admire about them?
I really want to limit myself to the current business leaders who are alive, because we have a whole universe of really inspirational people we can look to on a spiritual and business level. I like Richard Branson. Sir Richard Branson has done amazing things globally. He seems to carry success and his attitude with aplomb. He is well-liked by his employees, by his clients, by his competitors. He's extremely successful. He has his share of failures. We all do. He seems to focus on the positive rather than the negative. And he still finds time to lead a life that shows some personal passion and personal interests. I think that's something we could all aspire to.
All right, question number two. What is the last podcast you listen to, even if it's a guilty pleasure?
I don't really have time for guilty pleasures. I have been listening to a few cooking shows lately. I don't know if that's guilty pleasure or necessity, but the last audio recording I listened to was actually the book Theranos, about the blood testing company in Silicon Valley and the challenges of growing that company, navigating through the venture capital life cycle, the patent process, and ultimately the demise of the company.
What is the last book that you've read, fiction or nonfiction, that you would recommend to our listeners since you just couldn't put it down?
What is of interest to me may not be of interest to everyone else. I love data. And James Glick wrote a book recently called The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood. And he talks about the mathematical equation of information developed by Shannon, working with IBM in the 1940s. Amazing book, amazing history of data, information, chaos, digital science. I found it really took a lot of what we deal with on a daily basis, put it in a new perspective, gave me a richer, deeper understanding for it. And for someone who works in e-discovery, I highly recommend it. It's not enough if we want to excel to just be in the business. We need to understand what is it we're dealing with. Why do people seek information? How can we improve that experience? These scientific approaches are not the only answer, not the only facet or perspective, but they enrich it so much. I highly encourage that book.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate you being with us today. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners as we end the program?
I really look forward to some moment in the future when I get to ask Clinton Sanko the questions I want to ask. Until then, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I think anytime we have a chance to stop what we're doing on a day-to-day basis and reflect on where we're going, a little bit more perspective is important. What I get from moments like this really is not the chance to talk about what I believe, the feedback I get from the audience. So I encourage any comments, any feedback. I want my organization and my employees to be the best possible, to have the best possible experience. So every time I do this, I learn a lot.
Thanks for joining us on the Lean Discovery Applied podcast, Season 1, Sitting with the C-Suite. Please rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe so that you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. You can also visit us online at www.leandiscoveryblog.com, where we have additional content and videos of the interviews. Lean Discovery Applied is hosted by Clinton Sanko, eDiscovery Officer of Baker Donaldson. This program is not intended as an endorsement and does not constitute legal advice. Thanks to Baker Donaldson, a leader in innovative legal services, for supporting this podcast, to the guests, and to you, the listener. See you next time.